It's my great delight to introduce our president, Jackie Eales. Jackie is Professor of Early Modern History at Canterbury Christ Church. For those who were at conference last year and those who have heard Jackie talk in the branches, and I think she might be trying to break Anne Curry's record of talking to as many branches as possible, but you know you'll be in for a real treat. I've been particularly intrigued by Jackie's ability to shine a light on the character of individuals and to really show them in quite a personal, quite different way. And Jackie is perfectly attired in her Elizabethan waistcoat. And today she'll be looking at Elizabeth I. How glorious was Gloriana? So, Jackie, thank you.
Well, I really should have put on a ruff and a farthingale, but you can just see the top half of me, that'll have to do. So thank you very much, and welcome to everybody to the conference. How glorious was Gloriana? Well, you'll probably all remember that in 2002, Elizabeth came seventh in a vote of the top 100 greatest Britons of all time. She was the only woman in the top 10, which included Winston Churchill and Oliver Cromwell. There are probably more books about Elizabeth and her reign than on any other monarch. Now, apart from the numerous biographies and monographs, Chicago University Press has also been publishing her collected works. And to date, there have been 4 volumes on her letters, her translations, her poems, her speeches, and other writings. Elizabeth is admired today for her power dressing and her power portraits, her political acumen and her success in a man's world, a world of thugs, as David Starkey described the court of Henry VIII. Now, you can even learn how to be a successful CEO by studying Elizabeth's leadership style. And this audience will be particularly interested to know that one such business manual has been marketed as not boring history, but packed with practical actions for effective leaders. Now, the adulation of Elizabeth, of course, started during her own lifetime. She was represented as Gloriana by Edmund Spenser in The Faerie Queen, and she was also likened to Astraea, a Greek goddess of justice, and to Deborah, an Old Testament judge, to name but a few powerful and classical female figures. Elizabeth was praised as goddess, and even as a celestial power. And this is reflected in this very well-known portrait of her, which I'm sure you all know, the rainbow portrait. And in Latin it says, on the left, there can be no rainbow without the sun. So Elizabeth is being likened here to the sun. But we've also got this absolutely extraordinary costume covered in eyes, ears, and mouths. And Susan Doran has suggested that reflects the good counsel of the Cecils, father and son, William and Robert, who were her chief ministers during her reign. And of course, this portrait is at Hatfield House, the house of the Cecils. The date of it is unknown. We don't know exactly when it was painted. Some people have suggested it's around about 1601, so at the very end of her reign. It certainly, I think, dates from the 1590s, perhaps the mid-1590s, when, bear in mind, she was in her 60s. And this portrays her as a very young, youthful figure as well. And even the image of the serpent on her sleeve there, Susan Doran argues that that also relates to the idea of wisdom and good counsel coming from the Cecils. So that's rather an intriguing interpretation of that image. When Elizabeth died, of course, her reign was hailed as a golden age. Here we have the funeral procession for Elizabeth, with the image of the Queen on the funeral bier being carried with the coffin underneath, and great train. This is only a part of the funeral procession, but her ladies, her courtiers, all proceeding with her, and her banners of honour there flying. And this was a magnificent state funeral, and it gave her people one last occasion to experience the power of Elizabeth's image. The historian John Stowe, writing shortly afterwards, wrote, "They beheld her statue and picture lying upon her coffin, set forth in royal robes, and there was such a general sighing and groaning and weeping and the like hath not been seen or known in the memory of man. So remember, this is the first funeral from monarch for a very long time, 45 years. So this is something extraordinary that people are experiencing, many of them for the first time. Now, there was also a rush to eulogise Elizabeth in print as well. So we've got, this is from 1603, the year of her death, an elegy upon the death of the high and renowned princess, our late sovereign Elizabeth, by John Lane. So that was one such. But there was plenty of other material in print, eulogising her reign, eulogising as a person, and lamenting her passing. Now, we should note, however, that some of these authors had an eye to the new monarch as well, to King James. So we've got Eliza's memorial and welcoming King James, his arrival at the same time, from 1603. And this was written by a man called Anthony Nixon, who was clearly hoping that he was going to get patronage from the new king, from James I. Elizabeth's queenship was also soon set in stark contrast to the rule of the Stuarts, the two early Stuarts, James I and Charles I. And the first history of Elizabeth's reign was written by William Camden, and it appeared in English for the first time in four volumes between 1625 and 1629. This is Camden's Annals, or the history of the most renowned and victorious princess, Elizabeth. And you can see her image there to the left. And also on the right, there are images of famous battles that the English fought and won against the Spanish. And somewhere there's the Armada Crescent formation you'll be able to pick out. And there are various other battles that are celebrated here as well. There's Cadiz, 1587, Puerto Rico, 1591, and Cadiz again in 1596. Not that those expeditions were always great successes, they weren't. But in Camden's version, of course, they become great victories. And of course, being published in the early years of Charles I's reign, Camden's stress on these victories against Spain invited a comparison with Charles I's disastrous foreign policies. In that period, Charles went to war against France and Spain simultaneously, the two great superpowers of the age. And there were various naval disasters at La Rochelle, for example, in 1626. So it's very easy to use Elizabeth to beat the Stuarts with. And this is done again by Sir Robert Naunton, who was writing in the 1630s. And in his book called Fragmenta Regalia, he complimented Elizabeth for balancing court factions and for remaining above faction and being able to control her politicians, her courtiers. The principal note of her reign, he wrote, will be that she ruled much by faction and parties, which herself both made, upheld and weakened, as her own great judgment advised. Now, of course, historians have actually suggested that this isn't true, that faction may not be the right word to discuss the court politics in Elizabeth's reign in any case, and Elizabeth wasn't actually able to control court parties, court factions, in the way that Naunton was suggesting. But Naunton's comments and the whole work are a not very coded attack on the court favourite at the time, the Duke of Buckingham. And of course, the title goes on to say observations on the late Queen Elizabeth, her times and favourites. So it's very much angled at Buckingham as well. Now, Elizabeth's court spin doctors and her early historians like Camden and Naunton have clearly had an enduring influence on the way the Queen is popularly viewed today. Quite recently, though, in the last 25 years or so, there's been a trend in academic historical writing towards dismantling the glorious image of Elizabeth I. And even the most iconic episode in her reign, her Tilbury speech from 1588 during the Great Armada Crisis, has been questioned. The elements that we know about have all been deconstructed and questioned. Now, you can picture her now, can't you? Or even Glenda Jackson or Kate Blanchett, if you want to. And there we've got Kate Blanchett on the left, and she's just showing off her Van Brace there rather nicely. We've got Helen Mirren and Glenda Jackson. They've gone for the gorget around the throat, very nice. And on the right at the bottom, we've got Kate Blanchett again in full armour. And Flora Robson, of course, has gone for the traditional interpretation with the breastplate. So we've got them all there. Now, if you can picture Elizabeth at Tilbury dressed with the breastplate and making that famous speech about the body of a weak and feeble woman, but the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too, I want you to stop right now. Stop doing that. Because there are no consistent eyewitness accounts of what actually happened, how she was dressed, and what she said. We don't know whether she wore armour, and even the words of the speech only exist in later 17th century versions. Now, this is probably one of the earliest depictions of Elizabeth at Tilbury, and she doesn't seem to be wearing the breastplate there. This is from St. Faith's Church in Gaywood. Has anyone ever seen it? I think it must be absolutely spectacular. I've seen it in exhibitions, but in situ it must be absolutely spectacular because it's part of a diptych. There are two images, Elizabeth at Tilbury. The other one is the foiling of the gunpowder plot in 1605. And this was obviously given to the church by the minister at some point after the gunpowder plot. So it's not even contemporary with Tilbury. But what it tells us is about the defeat of the Spanish and Catholics by Protestant England. And there we have Elizabeth, of course, on the white horse, and this is where the idea perhaps of the white horse comes from. Now, the Tilbury speech itself was first printed in the 1650s. There's no printed version before that. That's the version we know. The earliest manuscript version of it has been dated to 1623, but even that date isn't secure. We're not entirely sure about the date. Could be wrong. And this has caused much debate amongst literary scholars and historians, with Francis Teague and Susan Fry on the one hand arguing that we know nothing about what Elizabeth said in her speech. In contrast, the editors of Elizabeth's collected works consider that there can be little doubt that her speech was reasonably close to the text that we know today. But Christopher Haig, the historian Christopher Haig, was one of the first, about 25 years ago, to emphasise the contemporary negative reception to Elizabeth's style of queenship. In 1988, his Longman profile in Power, entitled simply Elizabeth I, did a much larger job of deconstructing the image that we have of the glorious Gloriana. In particular, Haig focused on the last decade of Elizabeth's rule in the 1590s and just before she died. And he argued that the ageing queen appeared to be increasingly isolated. She was indecisive. She ruled with a narrowed privy council, and she was unloved by her people as well. In 1596, Haig noted, the privy council ordered the destruction of all unflattering portraits of the Queen, showing her as an old woman. And there's one that escaped. This was recently discovered in America in 2012, and it's been authenticated. It is probably by the studio of Marcus Gearhartz, who was painting in England in the 1590s. So it's from the mid-1590s. And it's Gearhartz's work that provided the template for portraits of Elizabeth in the 1590s. But you normally see a softened portrait of her face. You don't see all these wrinkles. So that's quite unusual. Now, Haig even concludes that there was impatience for the Queen's death. He tells us that on the day that she died, there were street parties, there were bonfires, and the people cried out, "We have a king." So that's in great contrast to Stowe's description of people sighing and groaning. Perhaps he was present when the cortege went past and he noted how people reacted to seeing the Queen's coffin going by. But by the evening, Haig tells us, people were celebrating the fact that there was going to be a king, a man on the throne again, an adult male ruler. Now, Haig's interpretation dovetails very neatly with Patrick Collinson's description of Elizabeth's England as a monarchical republic, the title of a lecture that he gave in 1986. And in that lecture and in subsequent work, Collinson stressed the extent to which Elizabeth's Privy Council operated as a body that was independent of the Queen. her councillors challenged the Queen's policies and pressed her to take different action to the action that she wanted to pursue. They chafed and they criticised her when she didn't take their advice. And Haig's interpretation also endorses this view. Haig describes Sir Thomas Smith, who was her Secretary of State, waiting in 1575 for the Queen's orders about Ireland, and complaining that her irresolution doth weary and kill her ministers, destroy her actions, and overcome all good counsels and designs. Now, there's a clear message in what Smith is saying, that all good policies and advice come from her ministers. She should listen to her ministers. And we can think of many examples, many issues, where the Privy Council and Parliament advised Elizabeth to adopt a certain policy, and she refused. On the issue of marriage, for example, this is one of the biggest policies where she was at odds with her ministers for some of the time, certainly. It was a pressing point at the start of her reign, when she became queen in the late 1550s, when she was a young woman, of course, she was in her 20s. But it became more pressing in 1562, when she suffered from smallpox, and there was a fear that she would die without having an heir, without naming a successor. So there was more pressure on her in 1562, in Parliament, 1563. But as we know, she refused to do so. She created the image of herself as the Virgin Queen, the mother of the nation, married to her nation as well. We can also take the famous deliberations about the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, in 1587. The story about how the death warrant was brought to her, and she absentmindedly happened to sign it in a pile of papers, and then it was sent off by her secretary, William Davidson, to be carried out, is well known. Of course, Davidson ended up being tried, put in the Tower, fined an enormous amount of money, but then being let off mysteriously. And the accounts about that episode are very difficult to get to the bottom of, whether Elizabeth knew what she was signing, whether Davison acted too quickly, and so on. But nevertheless, the death of the Scottish Queen had been debated in Parliament in 1572, and Elizabeth had come under great pressure then because of the Ridolfi plot, the Northern Rebellion, to execute the Queen in 1572. And again, she refused to give in. She was pressed again in 1584 by Parliament, very heavily by her ministers, to have the Scottish Queen, Mary Queen of Scots, executed after the assassination of William of Orange by a Catholic fanatic. And again, Elizabeth refused. Christopher Haig also emphasised in his biography of Elizabeth how the fact that Elizabeth was a woman, and of course we can't really overlook that, how that created particular problems for her as a queen. The most famous attack on female rule, of course, had come from John Knox at the very start of her reign. And this is the famous comment from his book, The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women. And this always conjures up an image in my mind of a regiment of women marching down the high street with muskets slung over their shoulders. But of course, regiment in this case means, it's like our word regime, it means government, the government of women. And you can see what Knox is saying here, that to allow a woman to rule is against nature. It's repugnant to God. It's against God's will and ordinance. And it's a subversion of good order. Mm-hmm. Everything is turned upside down. Now, we know, of course, that when Knox wrote this book, he was writing against Mary Tudor. Knox was a Scottish Calvinist cleric who was in exile in Geneva at the time. The book was published in Geneva. And it came out weeks before Mary Tudor died. And the blast was aimed not just at Mary Tudor as a Catholic, but also Mary of Guise, who was regent in Scotland on behalf of her daughter, Mary Queen of Scots. But it was published just as Elizabeth was taking the throne. And Knox was rather wrong-footed, although he never gave up his objections to female rule. He would have preferred a Protestant queen to a Catholic queen on the throne. So Knox had two agendas. He was against female rule, but he was also against Catholic rulers as well. And he was answered by Thomas Smith, Elizabeth's Secretary of State, who argued that women could inherit power and property, But they couldn't be elected to office, so they couldn't be elected to serve as members of parliament, they couldn't be chosen as sheriffs and so on, but they could inherit a dukedom, for example. They could inherit a throne by blood, by the right of blood, as he said. And another of Elizabeth's supporters, a man called John Aylmer, the future Bishop of London, another Marian exile, also argued that Elizabeth's succession was clearly the will of God, and moreover, he said, she won't make any mistakes because, of course, she'll be guided by her wise Privy Council, who are all men, so they will take the decisions and she will be guided by them. Now, he wrote that at the very start of Elizabeth's reign and may have been surprised at how independent Elizabeth proved to be. Knox's views, though, were very extreme. You don't find many people expressing this kind of idea in print in this coherently argued, logical way. And Susan Doran has made the point that apart from Knox, she says, barely a murmur was heard querying the legitimacy of female rule in 1558. I think this statement, though, ignores the extent to which there were probably concerns lower down the social scale amongst Elizabeth's subjects about having a queen, about having a queen on the throne, queen regnant. And it's interesting to see how far Knox's views were articulated by people apart from courtiers and clerics. If we look at the Kent Assize records, for example, there's clearly concern there about the legitimacy of female rule amongst ordinary people. We've got this indictment from 1559, Peter Hall, a clerk in Kent, who was indicted for seditious words. He says that the Queen shouldn't be a ruler or be supreme head of the church. We know that there is this big debate at the beginning of Elizabeth's reign about whether she should be governor of the church or supreme head, whether a woman can be head of the church, whether a lay person can be head of the church, and she goes for the title governor of the church instead. Now, we don't know exactly what happened to him. He was found guilty. We don't know what the sentence was there. We have another case from a decade after the Queen had become had taken the throne, from Kent again, from Maidstone, seditious words. And the same kind of idea that Elizabeth was the governor of the church and therefore the world was at odds, there's something wrong, and the world won't be put to rights until the Queen is dead. Now, he was found guilty and imprisoned for a year and fined £10. There's a later case from the 1590s from Kent where the chap who made the seditious comments was executed. But he wasn't executed for being rude about the Queen. He was executed because he'd stolen a horse. Now, I'm surprised if I'd been Elizabeth I, I would have said off with all their heads for these kinds of comments. Now, there are also, of course, concerns from Catholics, both at home and abroad, about Elizabeth inheriting the throne because she was seen as illegitimate by Catholics. They regarded Catherine of Aragon as the true queen, the true wife of Henry VIII. The marriage to Anne Boleyn was illegitimate, and hence Elizabeth herself was illegitimate. She was a bastard. She was also a heretic as well. She was seen as a heretic. So, of course, we get the excommunication of Elizabeth in 1570 and the Pope saying that it's all right to assassinate her or to depose her. Elizabeth's sex was also used against her, and in 1560 to 61 and again in 1570 to 2, there were rumours that Elizabeth had given birth to numerous illegitimate children, and this may be linked to the Catholic idea that she was illegitimate herself, like mother, like daughter, what can you expect? The illegitimate children in Elizabeth's case were said to have been murdered, their births were hidden, and the babies were murdered to avoid scandal. And the first spate of rumours were associated with the death of Robert Dudley's wife in 1560, Amy Robsart, who'd been found dead at the foot of a staircase in his home in very suspicious circumstances. And it was widely believed at that point in time that Elizabeth would marry Dudley. So these scandalous rumours are circulating, possibly as a way of trying to prevent the marriage as well. The second wave of rumours from the 1570s were associated again with a period of instability surrounding the Northern Rebellion and the Ridolfi Plot, both of which, of course, were in favour of Mary, Queen of Scots. So again, it's trying to rake up the idea that Elizabeth herself is illegitimate, I think. Now, an underlying theme in the seditious outbursts was the belief that as a woman, Elizabeth would be unable to control her male courtiers, and that she was, in a sense, the plaything of her Privy Council. She was a pawn, she was a cipher in their hands. These kinds of seditious stories about Elizabeth, because she was a woman, circulated right up until the end of her reign, as I mentioned earlier. And there were stories that Dudley was the father of her children that were circulating again in 1590 and 1591, when an Essex man also complained that the Queen was but a woman and ruled by noblemen. So she never really managed to sort of chase that idea away. Christopher Haig says that in particular, the desire for a king was behind some of these comments, both amongst ordinary people and at court. And in 1592, the Lord Deputy of Ireland, Sir John Perrott, was accused of treason. And part of the evidence against him concerned his complaints about Elizabeth. One of the comments he's meant to have made was, "This is it to serve a base, bastard, pissing kitchen woman." So again, the idea that Elizabeth was illegitimate herself, a bastard. "If I had served any prince in Christendom, I would not have been so dealt withal." Now, such negative reactions to queenship and to female rule are explored in much greater detail in a collection of essays edited by Julia Walker, which some of you may know, but which goes under the glorious title Dissing Elizabeth, Negative Representations of Gloriana, and that was published in 1998, if anybody wants to follow that up. I think, though, that these kinds of negative comments about Elizabeth, which I've been exploring this morning, need to be placed in a much wider context. The Tudor and Stuart assize records and treason trial records show seditious words were spoken against male rulers again as well. Henry VIII, for example, Charles I, even Oliver Cromwell, were the subjects of libels and slanders. And you find similar penalties and fines being handed out to some of the people who complain about Cromwell and Charles I. The image of Elizabeth as the pawn of her male advisers is subtly reinforced, of course, by Collinson's concept of the monarchical republic. But this also, I think, has its parallels in male rule as well. I don't think Elizabeth was alone in working with her Privy Council and sometimes taking their advice, sometimes rejecting it. At times, of course, Henry VIII and James I were notoriously more interested in the hunt than in going through the paperwork generated by their ministers. And the one early modern monarch who did make a virtue of overactive decision-making, of course, was Charles I, and his policies brought Britain to a series of civil wars. So if the interpretation of Elizabeth's queenship has been subject to revision over the last 25 years, is there anything left that was glorious about Gloriana? As Susan Doran has pointed out, the critics of Elizabeth tend to ignore the positive statements about the Queen that were made during her lifetime by those who knew her and saw her. Perhaps that's because such vignettes are very well known. They are used in a lot of biographies of Elizabeth. They've been used over the centuries. We know about them. But I think they're also worth reconsidering in the light of what we've just heard about negative comments about her. Let's take an account by Geoffrey Goodman, who was a young law student in 1588, after the Armada had been defeated. And in December of that year, he was told that if he wanted to see the Queen, she was coming out of a meeting with her Privy Council and she was going to be walking or riding down the Strand, he would be able to see her. And he went out into a dark December evening, waited for an hour and a half, and eventually the Queen came out. She emerged, as he said, in great state. And the crowd twice called out to her, "God save the Queen." And twice she replied. And the second time she replied with these words, You may well have a greater prince, but you shall never have a more loving prince." Now, I think that was a pretty clever response to the adulation she was getting from the crowd. And these may be rehearsed words. She may have said them to other crowds at other times. But what's striking, I think, to us today is the fact that she replied to the crowd. Today we have a monarch, Elizabeth II, who goes walkabout. She may talk to a member of the crowd here and there, but she doesn't address the crowd spontaneously and off the cuff. She doesn't respond to the cheers from the crowd in quite the way Elizabeth would have done. And this vignette also raises questions for us today about how the Queen responded. How did Elizabeth I respond? What did she sound like? What was her voice like? Did she need elocution lessons like Margaret Thatcher, for example, to sound more authoritative? Did she have a loud voice? Were people able to hear her at a distance, or could only people very close to her hear what she was saying? What we know from such encounters is that, in the words of the business manual I mentioned earlier, Elizabeth certainly knew how to work a crowd. She was very good at it. Whether rebuking the Polish ambassador in Latin for rudely turning his back on her, or addressing her parliaments, Elizabeth was also a very powerful orator. She was renowned for being able to make speeches that were powerful, that were often spontaneous. And we know from her tutor, Roger Ascham, that she was skilled in languages. Her surviving translations show that she maintained her linguistic skills all the way through her life. She was adept at Latin, Greek, French, Italian, and she carried on translating, practicing her language skills throughout her life. So we know that this is something she's very proud of. One of the questions that the editors of the collected works of Elizabeth asked is, to what extent did Elizabeth write her own letters and speeches? Was she merely a cipher of the Privy Council? Did they draft everything? Did she sign it off? And perhaps that's only a question we might ask of a queen. We might not ask that kind of question about kings, but it's worth asking. There's evidence in her paperwork of very strong collaboration with her ministers, with her privy councillors, and with her secretaries of state, that she would often dictate a first draft, they would work on it, they would polish it, and she would sign it off before it was allowed to go. When we come to the parliamentary speeches, though, they seem to be extemporary. There don't seem to be copies that were made in advance that she then memorised or took with her to speak from. The copies that we have tend to be made later by people who were listening to her. Perhaps they wrote down notes, but then they wrote them up later. So we've got different versions sometimes of the same speech because different people heard it and they circulated their own version. And the editors of the collected works have had to pick and choose which version they think is most authentic. So if Elizabeth had a great input into her public pronouncements, what about her influence over policy? How much was she in control of policy? If we listen to Collinson, it's a monarchical republic. She isn't so hands-on. But if we listen to Susan Doran, who concludes in the British Library Historic Lives series, we hear about Elizabeth as not a cipher to her Privy Council. She was, as Doran says, charismatic and a hands-on ruler. Now, I would take that a bit further. I would argue that the critique of Elizabeth as indecisive, as parsimonious with honours and with military aid to the French and to the Dutch Protestants, you can turn all that on its head. And when you look at it the other way, if you take away the criticism and look at it as a virtue, you can see that Elizabeth didn't overextend her nation's military and financial resources. Unlike Charles I, who of course embarked on these two wars against two great superpowers in the 1620s, which led to a decade in the 1630s of debt, legacy of debt, an attempt to find new ways of raising new finance in the 1630s, and of course discontent, which contributed to the civil wars in Three Kingdoms. Now, above all, I think that Elizabeth's policy of wait and see, don't take decisions when you're pressed by the Privy Council, by Parliament, wait and see, I think this has been misinterpreted as female indecision. It's been interpreted as a woman who can't make up her mind. And in 1955, for example, Geoffrey Elton in England Under the Tudors wrote, or described Elizabeth as, persistently dilatory. She changed her mind as often as chance offered, exasperated everybody by her refusal to come to decisions, and charmed them all back again by some transparent piece of graciousness. I think historians have missed, though, a significant piece of evidence which has been recently published in the collected works. Whoops. And this is this letter that she wrote to the Duke of Anjou around about 1579 to 80, when she was involved in marriage negotiations with Hercule Francois. And if you see what she says there, she says, "I've used time, and it's better than reason." And then she says, "I'm going to tell you from my experience what I know and what is true, that people go away making rash judgments and they repent because they haven't weighed a better balance in the depth of their opinions." Now, I think there's a depth of political strategy there that isn't well served by the idea that Elizabeth is indecisive, that she changes her mind, that she doesn't know what she wants, because she is a woman. What can you expect from a woman? I think there is a political strategy there. I think this reveals Elizabeth as consciously deliberating as part of a wider political strategy. And I think that we should see this as the keystone both of her reign and of her political acumen. I think she deploys this strategy during Mary Tudor's reign, when she refuses to get involved in plots against her sister. She deploys it again when she refuses to have Mary Queen of Scots executed in 1572 and for 15 years thereafter. And of course, I think she deploys it when she wisely refuses to name her successor. Even Elizabeth's interminable marriage negotiations have been described by Susan Doran as a strategic element of diplomacy, of international diplomacy with foreign states. And Doran stresses in particular that this allowed Elizabeth to address Catherine de' Medici, Hercule Francois' mother, as "dear mother," because of the potential marriage between Catherine de' Medici's son and Elizabeth. And this is a remarkable counterbalance, Susan Doran argues, to the fact that Mary Queen of Scots actually was Catherine de' Medici's daughter-in-law and could address her as "dear mother." So Elizabeth is vying for that position at the French court, to be seen as a potential daughter-in-law. And that's perhaps why the negotiations were so long drawn out. So, in order to draw these themes together, I want to look at this in the round. I want to think about what we can learn from these different views of Elizabeth, the positive and the negative. As historians, I think we need to place the contemporary criticisms of Elizabeth within a series of wider contexts. First, we need to balance them out with the positive comments of her courtiers, her subjects, and her spin doctors. And I don't think the two points of view cancel each other out. What I think they do is they give us a much richer picture of how Elizabeth was viewed at different stages in her reign and by different groups of people. I've also argued this morning that we should compare reactions to her style of rule with reactions to male leaders as well. After all, how much enthusiasm was there for Henry VIII at the end of his reign, in the last years of his reign? I don't think you would have got much adulation for him. How much criticism did Charles I provoke when his Privy Council realised that the three kingdoms were all sliding into a series of civil wars? The fact that Elizabeth was a queen regnant, though, prompted contemporaries to express their views about her in ways that wouldn't have been relevant to a king. So they're only relevant to the fact that she is a woman. You won't find these kinds of comments about men. So the concern of Knox and others about the legitimacy of female rule is one such form of expression. You wouldn't find that about a king. Rumours about her scandalous love life is another form of expression linked specifically to her as a woman. The double standard operated then as now. There are different standards for the behaviour of women and men. Now, the fact that Henry VIII had an illegitimate son wasn't a great cause for common concern. But in contrast, the belief that the Virgin Queen, who claimed to be married to the nation, had borne children, was aired during unstable periods during her reign. Now, these negatives, I don't think, should detract from the achievements of her reign, some of which I've discussed. But ultimately, if success for a monarch is measured by the ability to take the throne and sit on it for as long as possible, until you die a natural death, then she was a very successful monarch indeed. Now, the self-image she wanted to portray was that of a glorious ruler. And in this, she was ably assisted by her spin doctors, her court artists, her poets, and her historians. And I think the fact that she was a queen, that she was a woman, allowed them to break free from some of the traditional praise of male rulers. They could actually start again. They could recast the mould of adulation and praise for her. Drawing from the classics and the Bible, they created an image of a woman who was endowed with superhuman, divine, and celestial powers. And this, of course, is the Ditchley portrait showing her standing on a map of England, her realm. And she is supersized Elizabeth here. She's also controlling the elements. If you look in the background, there's a storm going on one side, on the left, and to the left, of course, it's getting clearer, the clouds are brightening. And again, it's this idea we saw in the rainbow portrait, that she can control the elements. She is superhuman, she is celestial. And it's a very powerful portrait. And it was painted to celebrate one of her visits to Ditchley in around about 1592. It's also from Marcus Gearhart's studio. And you can see the similarity there in the face with the portrait I showed you earlier, the very lined, haggard-looking Elizabeth that you saw earlier. This is obviously the template for how she should appear in the 1590s, but this one's a bit more softened. She looks a little younger there. So as a woman, as a queen, and as the Ditchley portrait suggests, Elizabeth was literally larger than life. It's no surprise, then, if we continue to be dazzled by that image. But nor should we be surprised, I think, that we discover that at times her opponents and her critics wanted to portray Gloriana as having feet of clay. Thank you.